This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Those Wall Street CEO pay increases just will not be stopped. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Portlandia guest star Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, March 25th. Glad you could be with us today. And let's do our Friday special, the weekly wrap, taking a look at the big economic moves of the week. Today, I'm joined by Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Cardiff Garcia of the blog FT Alphaville. Hello there.
Hey, Molly. Hey, Molly.
So it seems appropriate that we start with GDP, which topped expectations but is still considered slightly weak. Catherine, what can we read into this?
I don't think we really learned a lot about the economy from this report. I mean, it was at least the GDP section of the report. It was mostly just, you know, a revision, not a big revision. Consumer spending was a little bit better than had been expected. The main news in the report was that corporate profits were way down for the second quarter in a way that's a bit distressing.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, Cardiff Bloomberg, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that at least this report provided some measure of comfort, right? Because I agree with Catherine that you can't read too much into any single GDP report. But this report also took place during a time when there were a lot of kind of fluctuations in global financial markets and when we're worried about slowing growth in other parts of the world and how it might affect us. So at the least, we can say that the U.S. economy certainly isn't falling off a cliff. It's just kind of continuing on its steady grind.
Relatively stable. Although J.P. Morgan is warning that when corporate earnings are low like this, a recession usually follows. In fact, they say that one is very likely within 2 to 3 years. Does that strike any chords with either of you? Does that seem likely at all, Catherine?
I mean, a recession is going to come at some point. There are ups and downs. I do wonder if taking the corporate profits numbers at face value is a little bit misleading because they were depressed by a couple of different things, one being the big settlement money that BP paid for the Gulf oil spill. So that took a big chunk out of profits. And, you know, I don't know that that is going to tell us one way or the other about whether a recession is on the horizon. And another reason why they were down is that energy prices have been so low, which arguably, you know, and that ate into energy companies' profits, of course. And arguably, that is maybe not so terrifying from a business cycle perspective, just because, you know, maybe that's going to help consumers be convinced to spend more money. So, you know, whatever the model has predicted in the past, I'm not sure that it, you know, that I would, again, take it without a grain of salt, given these other caveats.
Yeah, I largely agree.
We have the same conversation
well.
Every time, right? Which is, yeah, it seems like we keep having this conversation, which was, we don't really know. A lot of things are different than they usually are.
Well, remember that economists, a lot of times, will point to correlations that in the past were pretty strong, and that only later on we discover were really quite spurious. So in this case, they're looking at the relationship between earnings and the likelihood of a recession. But we know, for instance, that earnings at companies are being squeezed right now, in part because there's weakness in the rest of the world, and because there might be a little bit of potential wage growth in the economy now as more people get employed. But that can be a good thing, and the economy can still keep running so long as people are still getting jobs. So I'm not so worried about a recession coming based on a report like this, other reasons might emerge at some point. But I think to look at stuff that, you know, made sense in the past and to say that necessarily it's going to hold in the future is always something that we should be very cautious about doing.
Okay, plenty of wage growth, though, with Wall Street CEOs. The nation's six largest bank CEOs rose, let's see, an average of $20.5 million for each exec. And this is, you know, something that people are mad
just
about.
Just a few pennies. Yeah.
Shows no sign. Right. Shows no sign of slowing down no matter how these banks perform. You got about 15 seconds to tell me what's going on.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's not as if their profits are doing so well. It's kind of like down is the new up. You know, a number of these banks, they had big losses in profits, and yet CEO pay has gone up. I don't know if that's because of something weird in the contracts or there's just something really broken in the system. I don't know.
Catherine Rempel and Cardiff Garcia, thank you so much.
Thanks. Molly.
On Wall Street, U.S. and most European markets are closed today for the Good Friday holiday. We'll look at what's left over when we do the numbers. A little more on finance for a moment. You know Square, the company behind those little white credit card swipers you so often find at small businesses and the occasional food truck. Square is best known as a payment processor, but it's been branching out lately to offer other services. The newest is offering loans to businesses. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York.
Square explains its push into lending by pointing to folks like Giacomo Gianni, who owns Follicle Hair Salon in San Francisco.
We started 15 years ago with two chairs. And we are now up to 30 chairs.
Square previously offered cash advances, which Gianni has used to fund some of that growth. He likes Square loans because they're easier and faster than traditional banks.
Last time I went to the bank to do some expansion, it just was hours and hours of putting together paperwork and pulling out figures.
Banks need all that paperwork to assess risk, but Square already has loads of data from all the credit card transactions it processes. Mark Meyer teaches entrepreneurship at Northeastern University.
They can see if sales are going up or they can see if sales are going down.
But processing credit cards is still a world away from lending money. Trip Chowdhury of Global Equities Research is a big-time skeptic about Square and thinks it's making a mistake.
These are completely different businesses. They require different skill sets.
But Square thinks it can pull it off. Duke business professor Campbell Harvey agrees. He thinks the move will be good for shop owners as well. They've struggled to get loans to expand in recent years, even when their sales numbers are good.
Small businesses are the engine of economic innovation, growth, employment in the U.S. So anything that we can do to make it easier for them to pursue the projects that they consider valuable is a good thing.
Square's bet is that it knows enough about these businesses to figure out who to lend to. And as they grow, it'll grow too. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This week, the grocery chain Aldi started opening new stores in Southern California as part of its $3 billion expansion plan. The German company is aiming to have 2,000 U.S. stores operating in the next couple years. That's up from about 1,400 today. Aldi will face a highly competitive grocery market in Southern California, but experts say that its no-frills, low-price model make it one of the fastest-growing retailers around. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more.
Aldi operates in 17 countries and is a go-to grocery store in Germany, where it started. Now it's one of the hottest discount retailers in the U.S., a market it entered way back in the late 70s.
They are the overnight success that nobody has heard of after 30 years, 40 years.
Jim Hertel is a retail consultant with Willard Bishop and Inmar Analytics Company. He estimates Aldi's sales at stores open at least a year are growing between 8 and 10% a year on average, much faster than traditional supermarkets.
Those stores are growing on a dollars basis, maybe 1 or 2% a year.
Hertel says Aldi will have a lot of competitors in Southern California, including from Trader Joe's, which started in California and is tied to the same founding German family. Both chains have a limited selection and offer lots of private label items. But Hertel says Trader Joe's shoppers may seek something unique, whereas Aldi shoppers want a good deal.
They got good prices. Price is very good.
Mike Jones shops at an Aldi in St. Paul, Minnesota. He doesn't mind that the company keeps costs down by having shoppers bag their own groceries, but he's not a fan of paying a quarter to use a shopping cart.
because sometimes I don't have a quarter or, you know, that's the part, that's what I don't like is the shopping cart thing. But, you know, other than that, it's all good. I love Aldi's.
Aldi has started expanding its organic food brands, and Mike Paglia at Kantar Retail says some of the newer stores have a slightly more upscale decor.
Things like the color palettes, the lighting, the fixtures.
But he says at its core, Aldi's success still hinges on no-frills convenience and low prices. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
And now a check-in on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the pending trade agreement that involves 12 countries, including the U.S., and covers 40% of global GDP. Now, when I say pending, I mean that after more than 5 years of negotiations, the terms of the deal are finalized, but it still needs congressional approval. No problem, right? Right. The timing and the outcome of that vote are both highly questionable, especially given what a beating the TPP and trade in general have been taking on the presidential campaign trail. The White House is trying to build support for a vote before President Obama leaves office. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson checked in on that campaign, shadowing U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman for a day as he hit the road to pitch the TPP.
Nice to meet you, Mike Froman.
The suit is a given, but ties or no ties?
Should I put on a tie?
I've got one in the car.
U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman is coordinating with Congressman Sam Farr, a California Democrat.
I swore I wasn't going to wear a tie.
No ties wins. Farr sticks his in his pocket.
That way?
Have you been here before?
The two met last month at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, trying to build support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. As the country's top trade guy, Froman kind of owns the TPP. After years of negotiating the terms of the deal, he's now in sales mode, trying to convince Congress and the public that the TPP is a new kind of trade agreement. The ambassador and the congressman stop in front of a massive tank in a darkened room at the aquarium. Schools of silver sardines and other fish dart past.
Now, are these bluefin? Or?
Some are bluefin and some are yellowfin.
And bluefin are the ones that are sort of in danger now.
Yes.
Farr and Froman are at the aquarium to pitch the TPP's environmental standards, provisions they say will prohibit subsidies that contribute to overfishing and protect marine animals. There are some environmental groups who support the deal, but other louder groups do not. The Sierra Club criticized Froman for even coming to the aquarium and for not negotiating better protections for sharks, for example. I asked Congressman Farr about his support of the deal, despite how unpopular it is with the rest of his party.
So many of my party don't represent the kind of agriculture that I represent. I'm willing to take the heat. This area is...
Farr says pressure to get this deal done is going to have to come from people and industry, a bottoms-up process. But the TPP's path through Congress will be really tough. Republican leaders, who traditionally support deals like this, say they have some concerns about the final terms of the deal. Presidential candidates from both parties oppose it, including Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Ted Cruz.
I think we'll get it done.
I think we'll get it done, Froman tells Farr before leaving the aquarium.
We've got some ideas.
After a quick stop for a meeting with venture capitalists, Froman heads north to Stanford University. Five staffers travel with him, along with two security people and a police escort.
Well, thanks very much. Again, it's a privilege to be here.
At Stanford, Froman tailors his pitch to Silicon Valley.
It's the first trade agreement to comprehensively take on the issues of the digital economy. It promotes the free flow of data across borders and prohibits forced localization of digital infrastructure. No national clouds or regional internets.
Here, too, the TPP has its critics, like those who think it doesn't do enough to protect privacy. Outside, a handful of protesters hold signs like TPP equals profit over people and the planet. A tall, thin protester pushes his way into the auditorium and takes a seat. And when organizers hesitate to give him the microphone, Froman gives them the nod that it's okay.
My question has to do with these tribunals that will be decide or arbitrating any issues between, say, corporations and some of the host nations. And
this is a controversial part of the agreement that says if an investor from one TPP country thinks he's being treated unfairly in another, he can take his case to an international tribunal. Critics worry it gives foreign corporations a chance to challenge U.S. regulations they don't like. Froman says ISDS, this investor-state dispute settlement, is already in lots of trade agreements, and the U.S. has never lost a case.
And TPP takes it further than anywhere, any time before, to tighten the standards, close loopholes, add safeguards, to make it very difficult to prevail in an ISDS claim, except when what it's designed for, which is in the case of, for example, expropriation.
The guy actually kind of nods along while Froman is speaking and then leaves shortly after.
All right, you want to hop in the other side of this?
Sure. After still more meetings...
That was a good group.
Froman and co. finally head for their hotel around 8 o'clock.
What should we talk about?
I ask how days like this get him closer to a yes vote in Congress.
I think we're out here making the case for TPP and making sure that it's not just one side of the argument that's being articulated, that people see what's actually in the agreement, how it benefits them, how it deals with issues that they care about.
But trade can be an emotional issue. And the debate over TPP often slides into this referendum on trade and globalization in general.
We're not going to be able to change everybody's minds, and that's not our goal. It's not what's necessary.
Do you think that you changed anybody's mind today?
Oh, I don't know. I think you'd have to ask them. Even if we did not change their mind, if they were negative, hopefully they leave with a better understanding of what our perspective is. Hopefully an understanding that we take their views and concerns seriously. I was asked a question.
The next day, I tracked down that protester who asked Froman about the tribunals. He said he just didn't buy Froman's assurances.
Personally, I don't believe it. He said a number of things which I find very questionable. And so, no, I'm not convinced by what he said.
But he said he did appreciate the chance to ask. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the cost of a bus itself is about $400,000 before you hire the driver and before the first passenger gets on the vehicle and you put gas in it.
A city that's giving up on buses and switching to Uber. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. financial markets were closed today in observance of Good Friday. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the NASDAQ dipped 0.5%. The S&P 500 fell 0.7%. Market shut down for the day in Europe and most of Asia, but not in Tokyo, where the Nikkei gained 0.7%. Also open today, the Shanghai Composite Index, which rose 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. All across America, more people are migrating to cities and more people are using public transportation. But the country's mass transit systems are definitely not prepared to handle the load. The Metro in Washington, D.C. abruptly shut down last week for repairs, stranding about 700,000 commuters. In Boston and New York, weather, repair and maintenance issues have been closing subway stations and shutting down service. And for San Francisco Bay Area commuters like me, it's been a very tough couple of weeks. The subway up here is the Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, and it is melting down. Parts of the system have been shut down for more than a week. And this is just the latest BART snafu. People around here are used to feeling the pain.
They come in every day on BART back and forth, and it's just, I don't know, it's really hard to know when I'm going to get a train on time or not. Well, definitely the need is growing, absolutely. I think they may be, in spirit, trying hard, I just haven't seen the results.
BART is working on the problems. They do know how bad things are. But upgrading 40-year-old subway lines is not trivial. I visited Grace Cronican, general manager of BART, at the system's offices in Oakland. So, Grace, give us a little bit, just take a minute to give us an overview of kind of what's been happening in the last few days. We can sort of start there.
Over the last few weeks, we've had two sets of problems out on the track, and we know we have a power surge of some kind, which when it occurs, it fries out a component of the train cars, making them disabled. We've lost in one incident around 40 cars, in another incident around 80 cars that get fried. We have to take it out of service because we have over 30-year-old cars, 40-year-old cars in many cases, and the parts have to be found and replaced.
And I assume that that would be problematic no matter what. Can you talk to us about how much BART ridership has increased?
We've increased our ridership over 100,000 over the last 5 years. It's like sardines in our cars. If you ride the train in the morning, you just know what the person next to you has had for breakfast or what their shampoo is, because we're that close to each other.
And I assume the infrastructure hasn't kept up. I mean, it hasn't kept up anywhere in America with increasing ridership.
What's happened over the last few years is the Bay Area's economy has gotten to the point that it's on fire. I mean, it's just been popping. And the federal government dangled the promise of a long-term funding bill for the longest time and only recently passed it. But when they passed that bill, they didn't do anything to make up for inflation over the past. They didn't make anything up on the current inflation. In addition to that, over the past year, while the Bay Area's economy has been on fire, the funding from the state for BART alone has dropped $17 million. Hmm. We have a fantastic group of people maintaining these systems. They're highly skilled, they're highly educated, and they have stretched the life of these vehicles, they've stretched the life of the rails way beyond what it should have been extended. And now it's time to fix things.
What will that take to fix it?
So this November, the board is going to put on the ballot a measure that goes to the public that asks them for $3.5 billion to invest just in this rail system. Of that money, 90% of it is fix it first, and 10% of it is to address the overcrowding that we're suffering from.
And where else would the money come from if you're talking about a $10 billion need and a $3.5 billion bond measure? Where else? Is it federal funding and other state funding?
Yeah, over in the past, what we've done as a country is the feds have come up with some of the money, states have come up with the money, regions, local jurisdictions, local transit properties have come up with the funding. And you ask the question, what's going on nationally? And everyone has the same problem on their hands. They need to invest in the existing infrastructure. Some places don't have quite the growth demand that the Bay Area has on it, but they have infrastructure needs. If you look at Philadelphia and Chicago and New York and Atlanta, they all have the same problem we have.
And does that make it harder to get the federal funding or to at least figure out how to parcel it out?
Transportation is an investment in our future, and it needs to be viewed as an investment, not as a tax. It's a crime that we've had to tap into the budget to fund transportation. In the past, that always has been done by the gas tax, and we need to return to that. Congress should realize this is a problem.
How common is the BART story across the rest of America? Do you feel like this is a parallel story to a lot of transit infrastructures?
I do. The condition, not just of the transit structure, but of the roads and bridges, probably of the power system as well that's out there. As a country, we've had the opportunity over the last 20 years to invest in this system. The transportation system is what you're asking about now, and we haven't done it. The federal gas tax hasn't gone up since 1993. And internationally, we're competing with the world right now. And an investment in the infrastructure is an investment in a country's future. And I think we really need to get on it.
That's Grace Krunigan, General Manager of BART. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your interest. Appreciate it.
Now, Grace told me that the fix-it plans for the San Francisco BART system would take between 10 and 30 years. And that has to happen before any expansion or new build-outs can happen. Some cities have decided that they're just giving up on infrastructure. In Altamont Springs, a city just north of Orlando, Florida, officials had to abandon plans to build a brand new, technologically advanced, on-demand mass transit system, and instead, they're just using Uber. Here's Altamont Springs City Manager Frank Martz. Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very well. So tell us briefly about this project, this pilot program that you're running.
Yeah, absolutely. Our FlexBus when it was costed by the public agency, was about $1.5 million per year. Our anticipation with Uber is going to be around $100,000. So we budgeted $500,000, hoping for growth. The cost of a bus itself is about $400,000 before you hire the driver and before the first passenger gets on the vehicle and you put gas in it. The beauty of Uber is that it is not an infrastructure-based solution. You know, the public doesn't buy cars. The only thing the public does is market this as an alternative, and then we subsidize our own taxpayers with their tax dollars to take advantage of this potential mode shift.
I mean, certainly congestion and transit infrastructure is a serious problem in a lot of cities in America. Do you think this is a model that could spread elsewhere?
Well, it's the first time that a city has done a pilot project like this in the country, and we have gotten phone calls literally every day from cities who are interested in joining us and cities who are interested
on the East and West Coast and Middle America, everyone's trying to solve the same Rubik, and that is, how do you move people more effectively and cost efficiently? And public transit hasn't kept up with that curve, and demand for congestion management solutions grows. So we've seen a lot of people consider this a viable alternative for them to review and evaluate. And I would expect in the next 60 days, 3 to 5 more cities join our program.
3 to 5 more cities in Florida?
Yeah, immediately around ourselves in Central Florida.
That's Frank Martz, city manager for Altamont Springs, north of Orlando. Thanks so much, Frank.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, Marketplace has a whole series on this country's crumbling infrastructure. It's called The Weak Link, and it is at marketplace.org. This final note before we go, Nike got a lot of attention in the last week or so for its new self-lacing shoes. But you know what I have to say to that? Step aside, self-lacing Nikes, and hello, chicken and waffle Nikes. Nike SB, the company's skateboarding line, just announced a new edition of its Dunk High sneakers, which are designed to mimic chicken and waffles. No, for real. Chicken and waffles is a thing. Enough of a thing that these shoes feature a tan waffled texture and what appears to be delicious-looking syrup dripping down the swoosh. Previous models of the Dunk line have been inspired by such things as lobsters, tweed, and the number 13. Admit it, you kind of want to work there. And that's it for us. We are done. Markets were closed today, but they will reopen next week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Patty Hirsch has been our interim senior producer for the last couple of weeks. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I am Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.